and Professor David Kaur, the lecture moderator. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Wanto Wu needs no introduction in Hong Kong, nor indeed does he need it in any university for the China or Southeast Asia study program. In Hong Kong, Professor Wang is known first and foremost as Vice Chancellor of the University of Hong Kong from 1986 to 1995, and also from 1989, a member of the Executive Council of the Hong Kong Government. His service in Hong Kong has come after a distinguished career. He had come to Hong Kong from the Australian National University, where from 1968 to 1986, he was Professor of Far Eastern History and Director of Research School of Pacific Studies. The distinguished career continued upon his departure from Hong Kong. He soon became chairman of the East Asian Institute at the National University of Singapore, and a man of many appointments, he is now also chairman of the governing board of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Technology. However, Professor Wang is known not only for his administrative activity, he is actually known even better for scholars in Chinese and Southeast Asian studies to reports, of which there are many. You mustn't believe the list of publications attached to the web page at the East Asian Institute, which lists some 17 books, and I don't know how many papers. By no means a bad record, dare I say. You should go to the library catalog of Harvard University, which will give you 68 entries. I think they are incredible. I went over the whole list. Indeed, there are numerous entries. Five of them. His reputation was made from the first title, published in 1958, The Man High Trade, a study of early history of Chinese trade in South China Sea, which was his master's thesis at the University of Malaya. I gather from the publications that an interest in the overseas Chinese had come early. A small volume appeared in 1959 under the title, A Short History of the Nanyang China. Those few years were probably also the busy mind working on the PhD thesis. The degree was awarded by the University of London in 1959, and the thesis appeared in 1963 as the structure of power in North China during the Five Dynasties. I can picture young Professor Wang Zhengwu striding the South China Sea, coming to terms of China, Malaya, soon to be Malaysia and Singapore, the overseas Chinese, but being Chinese and being Chinese in multi-ethnic communities. He was born in Indonesia and educated in Malaysia. He must have known even this better than anybody else. The history of the waves of Chinese migration, seeking trade or political refuge in Nanyang, the Southeast. He must have known even then the complexities of ethnic identities, not only between the indigenous people, other migrants and the Chinese, but also the many overseas Chinese themselves. These were themes that emerged over the years in his many books. Books that taught him from understanding the overseas Chinese to understanding China, not only the China of the Five Dynasties, but also the China of his own day. And the China not only of the Chinese nation, but also of the many Chinas around Chinese communities, including Hong Kong. The gem in all this is the Chinese Overseas, the first band China to the Great Four Economy, published in the year 2000. Being his text for the Edwin O. Reichow Lecture at Harvard University, where in a slim volume you will find the most enlightening account of the history of the overseas Chinese. There is yet a third reason why Professor Wright is writing. He is frequently invited to speak on Southeast Chinese and the overseas Chinese. And for those occasions, he's known for his eloquence. I didn't know that was a reason for that until I started looking around. I mentioned it just now, but the internet, you say, there are few secrets. Professor Wang started out in his undergraduate days as a poet. I have your permission to read how one says from Du Taiyuan. Professor Wang says, "See the solid beginning, the first scales only the weak. Spring at the seeming saying, the world has a rugged tint. Pretty runs and resolutions are the coward's pain." I think only that can be a fitting introduction to our leadership lecture in history of India. Empire, Dunkor, Hemsha, China, and worldism. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of New Asia College, it is my honor to present to you Professor Raskin.
Very dangerous to be in the hands of a curious historian who starts looking up about your own past. I must say, this privilege also to be in this museum, brand new museum. I was still, I realized only after I left, and got the thing there. I remember when he was in the old museum, of course, the honor of being invited to speak in honor of my friend, Professor Yu Shiro, this is something that is very special indeed. When I was thinking about him the other day, it reminded me that I met his first teacher, and I spoke last night about the fact that I went to see Professor Chen Wu in the early days of New Asia College, at the time when Yu Shiro was a student, but I didn't meet him then. But I want to mention again because Professor Chen Wu, of course, is one of the great historians of this generation. And when I visited him in New Asia College, that was one of the highlights of my trip to Hong Kong in 1952. And one of the reasons why I went to see him was because I just read his new book called The Tung Guo Li Dan, Tung Guo Li Dan. Very important book and very thoughtful, and it's still great for me. Thank you, and I'm fun to see you, the author, and hear more about it from his own lips. He was very kind and talked to me, gave me a lot of ideas, items about reading, and so on. So that was something I thought I should mention, because that actually is related to my topic today. Because, as you can imagine, in 1952, it was still fairly soon after the 1949 so-called liberation of China and the establishment of New China. And I wanted to hear what Professor Chen had to say about what went wrong with the Chinese Empire. But many people at the time, most people at the time, who were watching affairs in China closely, we were very interested in what happened. The last years of the Qing Dynasty, the early years of the Republic of China, how did it all lead up to the victory of the Chinese Communist Party in 1949? It was a topic that left us somewhat puzzled in many ways, because there is very little in the history of the last few thousand years of Chinese history that could have led us to believe that the Chinese would one day be so fascinated by something like communism, Marxism, Leninism, and so on. At least at that time, that was a big mystery for me. So reading first gen book was such an eye-opener, and when I think about it, so as I said, it framed many of my thoughts on the subject of Chinese Empire, and even on the idea of Dong Guo and Chen Xia, the subject of my new talk today. So it was a revolution at the time that started my interest. And it was really a revolution that I think can only be compared with the revolution that created the Qing Han Empire 2,000 years earlier. So in between, there were a lot of changes, but at least in my mind, nothing comparable to what happened in 1949. Certainly the decades from 1912 to 1949, it was totally unknown in Chinese history. So it was something that caused me, and I think people of my generation, to give a lot of thought to what really caused this major change, what made this 2,000 years of history come to this extraordinary climax with the establishment of the China. So among the questions that I would raise, very basic questions, two basic ones. How is China placed in world history? Probably the Chinese see themselves. And why does this matter to the Chinese? And the question also is, why does it matter to the world? What happens? My talk is in two parts. First, I'll talk about China and world history. And then I will talk about Chinese history and the world today by using concepts like empires, Zhongguo, and Qingxia to illustrate some of the thoughts I have about changes in China during the past few decades. China and world history. Countries and civilizations with a strong historical tradition have always tended to write their histories as if each was the center of the known world. So China, as no exception, China was Sino-centric in its historical tradition, in the same way that Greco-Roman history or Persian and Arab history, each centered in their own way, it saw the world, the whole universe as we see it. But in modern times, in following the centuries of European domination of the world, Eurocentric history writing has become, I would say now, the master narrative of world history. It's been dominant for 700 years now. And today, the vast part of the histories written today are influenced by that, especially the Eurocentric view of how Europe became the most powerful force in modern world history. That narrative permeates modern history writing everywhere. I will try to cover all aspects of that narrative power. For my purposes today, I shall limit myself to comparing China's own narrative and this European narrative, which has become the basis of the master narrative of modern history. And I thought the useful starting point is to look at their respective known worlds, and China's known world and Europe's known world at the early periods of history to start with. As we all know, China's known world throughout its history was essentially continental. The greatest challenge for the Chinese people was to preserve the agrarian qualities that kingdoms and states against nomadic enemies who invaded China fairly regularly. China was not alone there, but there were others whose known world was also continental. For example, the Central Asian nomadic powers, and they were certainly very much continental. The powers that created the Shunzhou Empire, what was described as the Han Empire down in Europe, according to Han Shunzhou Empire, and of course, so many others, the various military federations, like the Tukulae, the Turks, the Uyghurs, several Mongol groupings, all through 1,000 years in history, different groups of Mongols. To the Turks who went to Europe, the Seljuks, the Mughals who went to India, and the Ottomans who created the Ottoman Empire, all of them came out of Central Asia. They were essentially continental powers, the same kind of continental concerns, but without an agrarian base, unlike China. And the difference was China had an agrarian base, and therefore it had special problems different from those nomadic peoples. Nevertheless, for all of them, the chief characteristics of their power was that it was continental based. It was power that was exerted over them. For agrarian China, This meant that the Chinese people are afforded limited mobility in contrast to the nomadic peoples who are accustomed to mobile, of course. The Chinese, therefore, spent most of their history concentrating on defending themselves, defending their agrarian societies, becoming strong invasions from these nomadic people. And they themselves refrain from moving very far, especially from refrain from moving beyond the eastern parts of the Central Asian plains, as setbacks. Only in one area did the Chinese make an exception, that is the ideas, the area of ideas and religions, the Chinese did make an exception. This is when their monks went to India to get Buddhist learning. And that is the only exception. The rest of it is very much inward looking, defending themselves against invasions. The Europe's known world, on the other hand, centered on the Mediterranean. That meant that their power systems were based on both maritime and continental power. More maritime, in many ways, than the Mediterranean, and how the history of Europe began. It's not rather limited overland power in comparison. And this began from way back, from the Egypt, from all those empires and kingdoms of the Fertile Crescent, which is now called the Middle East. And this was extended across the Mediterranean, right down, and then beyond in every direction. Southwards in Africa, northwards into the northern parts and western parts of Europe, and then also eastwards into Persia and right up to the Indian borders. Now the key feature of that known world for the Europeans was the close link between land and sea power. No power could dominate without the ability to control the sea. And that was true more or less throughout European history. Power was dependent on interlocking maritime forces with land and infantry forces. This dualistic mobility was extended in stages, first by the Greeks, for example, Alexander overland right through the Indian border, through Persia, into Afghanistan and Central Asia, and then by the Romans across the English Channel to the northwestern corner of Europe, but that's across the sea. But still, part of this mixture of land and sea power. And in that way, actually reached the Atlantic too, a different corner of the Atlantic Ocean, and then to take Britain, as you know, Julius Caesar and all that. Afterwards, after many centuries of exploration, that mobility was concentrated on maritime expansions across the Atlantic, and later became the continental powers in the American continent, both in North and South. And in that way, turned the Atlantic Ocean into what I call a second Mediterranean, reproducing the power relations of the Mediterranean, but across a much larger ocean. So I call it the second Mediterranean. And shortly after that, the Europeans also reached the Indian Ocean around the Cape of Good Hope, and beyond that into Southeast Asia. And that ocean became their third Mediterranean. It's not quite a Mediterranean, but I'm just using it rather loosely. Because that's where, again, the exercise of sea power became more and more dominant and more significant along all the shores of the Indian Ocean. So that's the third Mediterranean. And finally, from two directions, from the Indian Ocean as well as round the from the Atlantic, that power, from two directions, that power, that new European power, was extended across the Pacific Ocean. So this not only became their fourth Mediterranean, but also the basis for total global power that was created by the 19th century, in fact, slightly earlier. The power that is now essentially built upon an Anglo-American imperial heritage, and that's what it is today. In that way, the Pacific, this fourth Mediterranean, was much more significant than anything before because it provided the final pieces of the jigsaw that became the nexus of world power that we now see. So in comparison, we note that China,
they had opportunities, because if you look at China, they did have, after all, a long coastline. So it did have its own, I would describe it as semi-Mediterranean realm in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, which I just invented the term semi-Mediterranean, because it's not quite, there's too much open sea on one side. Semi-Mediterranean. But throughout the last 1,000 years, the Chinese have been reluctant, if not downright refused, to go beyond these waters. Even in this semi-Mediterranean, as they call it, China did not dominate militarily, but was content to exercise some kind of feudal control through a tributary system which they devised. Thus, China's known world remained confined for thousands of years, while Europe's known world expanded very slowly at first, but very steadily, and then very rapidly during the past 400 years. It is that expanded world that has provided us with what we now call world history, and the whole world history master narrative that dominates our history writing today. So world history today, as I said, this world history provides us with a master narrative, at least since the 20th century. And that narrative, as the historians have presented it, could be traced back to a series of ambitious efforts by European historians themselves who have tried to capture what Europe has achieved. And they did so to capture the glories of their remarkable achievements since the Renaissance by a number of historians, now not very often read, but by French and German historians who wrote their what they call universal history. It began with Voltaire and Mommsen in Germany and so on. And they were inspired, of course, by the travel accounts of all the sailors and explorers who went everywhere, but most of all by the writings and reports of the Jesuits who had gone to India, to Southeast Asia, to China and Japan, and sent their material back very systematically over more than 100 years. And the material, which is now located in the Vatican Museum, Vatican Library, provides an extremely fascinating account of how the Europeans first perceived that external world, but not just by travelers, but by very systematic scholarly people who were reporting with very serious purpose in mind, how do we turn this world into Catholics or into Christians. So extremely focused point of view, which became the dominant narrative that the European historians picked up. All that, of course, happened mainly in the 19th century. By the 20th century, I would say there was a second phase of world history writing, and some of the most successful exponents of this kind of history writing was really in the United States. Lots of textbooks for world history courses were created, especially from the 1960s and 70s onwards. A classic example of which was the work by William McNeill of the University of Chicago called The Rise of the West. Not the only one, but he was probably the best of the lot and became the model for many of the others that were written thereafter. And I would say this was probably the latest expression of the Anglo-American perspective of a larger European historiographical tradition, and the climax of this master narrative in many ways. There is probably something of a third phase beginning now, which draws from the master narrative, but is trying to develop alternative interpretation. And I think this is best represented by the editors of the journal called Journal of World History. First published in 1990, but for the last 18 years it's been developing a kind of maturity in interpreting world history, which is serious and something worth looking at. But the results are still new, and we can't predict whether all this will have a serious consequences on the master narrative, but I think the results are encouraging. And the coverage is extremely wide. It covers all aspects of world history, in my mind anyway, very fresh and original ways. Therefore, let me just sum up the master narrative that is dominant today, something like this. A sweeping story of the growth of Western power, the emergence of a new world order. That's the main thrust of the story. But it is a teleological, if I may explain it at the moment, the teleological approach, that is to say, it sort of assumes that all those events, those imperial events, must inexorably lead to the present, current international system. That's teleological. You know the end, and you go back and look for all the reasons that show why it had to end in this, arrive at this conclusion. And the ultimate, the underlying theme is that history is a progressive thing, and progress is then represented by the final results. Each step of the way, there's progress, which is in sharp contrast to, as you know, the Chinese tradition, which is cyclical. The Chinese don't actually expect the world to get any better. It comes down again, and you get the same story again, and you get the same beginning, and the same middle, and the same end, so to speak. That's a cyclical approach. But even another approach in Asia in general, and the Chinese are no exception, and that is kind of a golden age past from which we have actually deteriorated. It was much better a long time ago when human beings had just got worse and worse over time. So that's the opposite of the progressive approach. But the Western one, which has its roots probably in the Christian faith and that tradition, it is progressive. And therefore, things are getting better and better all the time, and it's inexorably reaching the point where European power offers leadership to the rest of the world and produces the conditions for a new international system, a new world order. So that is the sweep of the dominant tradition. Now, in this master narrative, relevant to my talk today, are three words that I think are very useful for us to try and understand where China fits in. And this is what I'm going to use to illustrate the points I want to make. The three words I take are key to that European progressive story are the words empires, nation state, and world order. World order, of course, refers to the current international system as operating today. But let me briefly explain. Empires, in this narrative, have been the norm for millennia, all through human civilization. From ancient Egypt to Mesopotamia to recent times. Never was a time when there were no empires, one kind or the other. And if the empires did not call themselves empires by that name, the narrative would fit them into a framework of empires of one kind or another. And there were many kinds. In the European narrative, in this master narrative, with the Roman Empire as the classic example, the classic model, and all other empires are measured against the Roman Empire. That's how it is presented. A major shift of emphasis came about with the rise of nation states. Now, exactly when that began is still controversial. Most people would date it from the Treaty of Westphalia in the 17th century. But whenever it began, the stages are roughly as follows. It began with some simple ones like Portugal and Spain. And the Netherlands, which broke off and became an independent state after the revolt against the Spanish Empire, the Spanish Netherlands, and then followed by the more powerful ones like Britain and France, and of course, one shouldn't forget, the newly independent United States, which Professor Martin Seymour Lipp said, once described as the first new nation, and in some ways that is exactly right. The first new nation state was following the American War of Independence. And then it was in Europe, in the 19th century, more and more of these nation states began to be established, with the best known powerful ones, those of Germany, Italy less powerful, and then in Asia, we had this exceptional case of the rise of Japan, as the first Asian nation state of any significance. All the other Asian states were more or less under some kind of European dominance by that time, and did not have the capacity to build their own state. Japan alone reacted quickly, responded to Western pressure, and very quickly imitated the West and created the nation state. They had the ingredients, of course, for doing so, and they did so rapidly and very effectively, as we all know. Now, from this development, the nature of empires began to change. I said, the empires are the norm. But the nation state created a new kind of empire. And that is the transformation into national empires. Which sounds like a contradiction. Oxymoron, if you like. But actually, that's what happened. In other words, the empires are no longer just empires as of kings and sultans or emperors and so on, but an empire which is based on a nation. One nation state begins to build empires which that nation state dominates. And the people of that nation state provide the ruling class, which has never happened before. It's not true in Roman Empire, not true in all the other earlier empires that one could think of. Many of them were basically feudal empires, but this one is not. It's a national empire. And it started about the 18th century with the nation states all acquiring enough power, particularly with Britain following the Industrial Revolution, which gave them a tremendous amount of release of power and energy that gave them that advantage over every other country in the world and gave them that lead. Of course, the rest of the world quickly followed, as you know. Germany followed very successfully, and eventually even Japan and Asia followed. But the model was there. The United States was, of course, the greatest beneficiary of that particular industrial revolution in a brand new nation state with the resources of a whole continent at its disposal. And of course, that was remarkable, because all the other nation states were given limited borders in Europe, and they had to fight one another all the time, which is why there are so many European wars for 300 years. Their borders were all limited. The United States alone had virtually no borders. And they could have the whole continent almost to itself. And therefore, the resources of that continent gave the United States an advantage which no other European country had ever enjoyed. So that's important to know. And so with these nation states being the base of new empires, they became the base of exclusive power for the members of their nation state, and gave them every reason for aggrandizing their national positions. This new norm, new kind of national empires, created now the maritime empires that we all know. The maritime empires that have spread, as I described it, from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, and then to the Pacific. Behind it now was a nation-state-based empire. This also meant that the age of national empires, including in some cases, a very few cases of land-based empires, but if you look at it, there's a difference. A land-based empire, I'll give you a good example, is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is different. But you see, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, if you look at it very closely, was essentially very feudal. It was still kind of left over, a residue of the old imperial system, just like the Ottoman Empire, which came out of Central Asia, was something else altogether. Quite different in nature from these nation-state-based empires which had spread into maritime empires around the world. In any case, when this age of national empires came to an end in the middle of the 20th century, the principle was that because they were nation-state empires, when their empires came to an end, all their armies and officials and so on were all taken home. They all had to return home and leave behind territories, one way or the other, independent or dependent or culturally dependent, whatever, neo-colonial, no matter what the status was, they left behind territories in the hands of the local peoples. So they return home. Now that's quite an important point which I should come back to. At least all of them did, were from Europe. All of them who did that were from Europe, except one, which is Japan. Japan also had an empire. The empire was in Asia, but they followed the same principle. When they were defeated, and the empire came to an end, they all went home to Japan, leaving behind Korea, Taiwan, Manchuria, which they had dominated for so long, and Southeast Asia, of course. At this point, the return of these national armies and naval forces from their empires to go home was accompanied by the claim that former empires did help to establish this new world order, and therefore empires were a good thing, but all good things have come to an end. They will all go back, and this new world order that they created was one that replaced, of course, the League of Nations, but the principle was the same. It was a world order based on nation states. Equal nation states, that's the ideal. And that is the United Nations after 1945. And from that time onwards, if you have this new order, there will be no need for empires anymore. End of the era of empires, a new era of nation states as the basis for a new world order. I don't want to spend too much time on this because, as you know, the Cold War confused this a great deal. New forces were at work. But I won't go into that because the point I want to make is that this was the gist of the power trajectories in the master narrative. Now, some people call it the end of the story of the Enlightenment project that underlies the master narrative, and they offered other interpretations. And I think these other interpretations interest the Chinese and actually is relevant to China's place in world history. And I have seen how Chinese historians in China today have been observing and following these other alternative or modifications of the master narrative quite closely. Let me take some of them just to illustrate the point. One of the approaches was to say this master narrative is too Eurocentric, too dominated by European concerns, and therefore not really applicable in many parts of the world. So one of the alternative ways is to use the comparative method to compare countries and treat them like equal units for comparison. So the comparative approach was to try and overcome the naked Eurocentrism that is found in many of the histories written by Europeans. They don't actually draw altogether away from the master framework, but they take it out of it to some extent and then try and compare China, and this is where China comes in, try to compare China with specific areas of the world at any one time to try and understand that. It can be very fruitful because to find out what are the key explanations for why some of the great powers became great powers. For example, just take a few which have been very strikingly successful. R. Win Wong's China Transformed, published in 1997. Kenneth Pomerantz, The World That Trade Created and The Great Divergence, two books published in 1999 and 2000, are some of the examples where Chinese economic development is directly compared with what happened in Western Europe at roughly the same time. So treating them as equal units worthy of comparison, which is not in the master narrative that the Europeans had devised. Earlier on, there were the writings of people like Wallerstein and his followers, scholars like Gunther Rath, who were already trying to revise this master narrative, but they did so largely in terms of a global economic globalization and the rise of trading structures and networks, and in a way trying to just take the emphasis away from power and military conquest into economic activities of a wide variety, and then show that the developments in Asia were as good as or as influential as the developments in Europe. And that's another approach. But that one, of course, has its limitations because it doesn't answer the questions in the main master narrative, which is all about power, about victory in war, conquest, and empires. So that doesn't quite help that one. Nevertheless, the fact that this comparative approach gives us a chance to look at China as equal to other powers. But in the end, up to now anyway, it doesn't actually take away much from the master narrative. It's just another way of offering a different way of looking at the master narrative itself. A second approach, which is also gained favor, and that emphasizes cultures and civilizations, getting away from the nation state, getting away from, again, war and power and conflict. And there, the comparisons would focus on matters of religion and values, value systems, with special interest in the growth of major, different, great traditions around the world, and treat the traditions as comparable, not countries or nation states, but the conditions, those civilizations as comfortable. And therefore, in that context, Chinese civilization is given an important place. But what I see weak in this approach is that the emphasis tends to be on past glories, stressing the decline and fall in modern times, particularly in the Chinese civilization. Glorious periods ending up in, sadly, with the fall of the Chinese Empire at the beginning of the 20th century and the collapse of the Confucian state. So in that way, Chinese civilization is admired, but admired somewhat like admired in museums, joining the great ancient civilizations like Egypt, Mesopotamia, perhaps even India. At best, it is compared with Greco-Roman civilization, but of course in the case of Greco-Roman civilization, that led up to to become the core of modern Western civilization. In the case of China, it did not seem to have led in any particular direction. Again, part of the Chinese own narrative of cyclical growth and change. Sometimes this emphasis on what might have been, and that's quite interesting itself, as in, for example, the history of science and science and technology in China by Joseph Needham. Now, that work is widely recognized. The Chinese historians appreciate that too. And that, of course, is a question of what might have been, supposing the Chinese had done this, that, the other, and invented science and discovered the scientific principle. What great things might have followed. So it's a kind of what might have been, and then they ask, why did the Chinese not become like that? So that's it's an interesting question. It doesn't actually help us very much beyond that. And similarly with the term her voyages, you've seen a lot of work on that also. What might have been with that kind of maybe? Why did the Chinese go further? What would have happened if the Chinese had actually stayed on instead of leaving it all to the hands of the Europeans in Asia by 1435, they pulled out altogether. And these are what might have been aspects of this particular approach. A third approach centers on people, societies, individuals, and their experiences. And here there's much interest in the environment, in diseases, for example. Very interesting. And because they cross borders. They've got nothing to do with political borders, nothing to do with civilizations. They're, by the way, human beings around the world have common problems and are attacked by common diseases, or common ailments. And the damage we do to the environment, climate change, all that has been going on for some time, and we're now reaping the consequences of past follies. And that's kind of one approach, a sort of human history approach. Here, China does not feature, not clearly anyway, except for certain areas in fine arts and literature, which is not quite what I think it's all about. But recently, there has been now renewed interest in health issues, safety issues in China, and tracing them back to early Chinese history, early concerns. But I think this is too early for us to see how this will affect the place of China in world history. A fourth approach is much clearer. This goes back to interstate relations, but as the key to understanding the successes and failures of various great powers. This looks at how the powers in their relationships behave. And in that context, it's quite clear that China was relatively isolated and had isolationist powers. Very easily defensive, very easily it closed its borders to try and hold whatever it's got, to try and prevent enemies from coming in, rather than taking many initiatives or taking a preemptive action against the outside forces. On the whole, Chinese agrarian philosophy was to hold what you have, keep what you have, and that does come out. And then in contrast to that, and that contrast becomes very sharp, in contrast to that, the very aggressive powers in Europe and their essentially expansive approach from the Mediterranean outwards, that difference comes out very, very clearly. And in that context, the explanations for why great powers became great powers was that if you're in conflict all the time and regularly fighting, you're more likely to be innovative, creative, you're more likely to actually build up the forces and technology in order to beat your enemy, and therefore make advances in science and technology and all the other things. Whereas if you are content to defend and hold what you've got, you are less likely to do that. You just enough to hold your enemy at bay, and when you succeed in doing that, you are content and to leave things more or less alone, and therefore your rate of progress, if you progress at all, is likely to be very limited, in contrast to the aggressive approach in history. And this comes out, of course, through this kind of analysis. Because China stands for isolation, and in this context, China therefore is on the periphery of the centers of great conflict, the centers of expansionist wars. China is on the edge. And all of China's efforts to establish some kind of regional order, space, through their tribute system to protect itself, is very a minor part of the story, not the main thrust at all. Because that was largely for trade control, a strategy for defending itself, and its position was still ultimately isolationist and limited. And it certainly created no such thing like a world order, despite my old professor, John King Fairbank, talking about a Chinese world order. I think he exaggerated that too much. But all these four approaches, not always entirely new, but by and large, they have made modifications on the master narrative. Some reinterpretations, some refinements here and there. But if you look at them closely, they haven't really moved very far from the master narrative, which remains the key one. There have been other more direct challenges, but I don't want to go into them now because they're not all that relevant for China. I will only make one last point before I move on, and that is in the case of the Chinese have been prepared to rewrite their history by using, for example, the Marxist class struggle approaches, stressing the progressive nature of Chinese peasant rebellions, and they use this step for decades now, from 1949, even earlier than 1949, down to the 1980s. This was still the main narrative in the PRC story, and it tended to limit the historians to one specific part of what was essentially a European narrative, because that's where Marxist ideas came from. It's just one of the branches, as it were, of Western perspectives on world history. But nevertheless, the Chinese showed by doing that, and that's the point I want to make, they are prepared to rewrite their history in a different way, in accepting the master narratives of the West, but they like one part of it more than the other part, so to speak. I leave it for that now, and say that the Chinese are ready to accept the master narrative, to try and escape from their own Sinocentric traditions. But of course, when you look at some of the developments today, you wonder whether they have totally given up on their own master narrative. So I'll come back to that now. And this is the second part of my talk, which is to relate this China to that master narrative more directly. And I think there are two questions which are dominant today, permeates the narrative. First is, does China add value to the world order? In some ways, the Chinese would say, and there may in the world today who would point to that the Chinese have offered something. They offered something like a kind of 政治挂帅 kind of a system, politics in charge. It stands for order and stability as the primary goal of good governance. It has instituted new respect for the idea of entrepreneurship that has liberated its people, and it's placed the greatest emphasis on economic growth before everything else. That is something the Chinese have to offer today. The second question is, can China stand in the way of the new world order by refusing to accept all the ideals that the Western dominated world order today demands? And the answer, if you take the Western narrative point of view, is yes, because China has a weak justice system, there's no rule of law, it offers little protection for individual freedom, and there is a lack of concern for political rights. These are just some of the obvious examples. And of course, this is very controversial between the Chinese scholars today and the Western critics of China today. But the overall question, how does Chinese history fit into the master narrative today? I've already mentioned that the Chinese have had this strong Sino-centric tradition, and that they are prepared to reinterpret that history since the end of the Qing dynasty, especially by those Marxist historians. That is already true. But now there are indications that the Chinese, while accepting the master narrative as being broadly correct, they have reservations. And where do the reservations come from and why they are there? I would like to use this, the rest of my talk to illustrate or explain that by comparing those three concepts that I raised earlier on about the master narrative, or empires, nation states, and the world order as a kind of straight line development, and compare that with the Chinese rather similar concepts, empires, 中国, and 天下, just to try and bring up this point that I'm trying to make. And to show why the Chinese have some significant reservations about how all these concepts from the West are applied directly to Chinese history. And when you apply them, it actually creates difficulties for China's present position in the current world order. Now, using the words empire, 中国, and 天下, I will focus on three questions. Are all empires comparable? Is my first question. The concept of empire in the West is fairly clear. I've already illustrated for you their norm, particularly the Roman Empire, as the classic example of empire. If this model was applied to China, and there are, of course, later empires, if it were applied to China, the way empires developed in history, if that trajectory of development was applied to China, then the question is, was there only one Chinese empire throughout all of Chinese history? Let me suggest that when you look at the outline of Chinese imperial history, it really is difficult for us to argue that there was only one Chinese empire continuously. In fact, not even a succession of empires. If you look closely, there are really several different empires and also several different sets of ideas of what empires should or should not be. Beginning at the beginning, you say that China began without any empire, without any idea. They had multiple states. They had a kind of vague idea of the Shang and Zhou dynasties. But essentially, when we come to the later history, it was a group of warring states fighting to set up an empire. And the first real empire in China was really the Qin Han Empire. And you look at the Qin Han Empire, which lasted for about 400 years, I think that was really an empire pretty much like the Roman Empire. You can't compare the nature of the Roman Empire to the Qin Han Empire, and you can say the Chinese did have one empire, very close. So in almost every way. But after that, was there any Chinese empire? As you know, with the fall of the Han, there really was no empire at all to speak of for about several hundred years until the Sui Tang reunification. Now, interestingly enough, how do the Chinese describe that? They describe that as a period of division, which begs the question, because the question is, that assumption is that the empire was the norm, and when it wasn't an empire, then it's a division, waiting for the norm, waiting to be united. And these are beautiful lines in the Shanghu Yeyi, how it says that, you get united, and what is united will be divided, and what is divided will soon be united. That's the assumption behind it. But is that a reality, or is it just a hypothesis, as it were, as a kind of the Mandarin, the Confucian scholar and the historian, working out and rationalizing Chinese history? So that's really the question. But if you look at what actually happens, what really happened was that when the Han Dynasty fell, and especially after the end of the Three Kingdoms, that was a period of division, yes. But after that, it was a series of invasions. The invasions of the Wu Luan Hua period, for example, invading from all directions. of the Xiongnu, of the Tobas, and the Tianbei peoples, of the Tibetans, and all of them came into China. And it took them hundreds of years to resolve that. And by the time it's resolved, you get the Sui Tang unification. But the Sui Tang, if you look at the details of it, as Chen Yingke and others have shown, they really are the structures built up by these invaders from outside. The Xianbei, Toba invaders, and their successors became the Sui and the Tang. But nevertheless, there was an empire. The Sui Tang created a new empire which united almost all the territories of the original Han Empire. But that only lasted for 150 years, because when you look at it closely, again, by the time of the Iron Shan Rebellion, there was really, after the Iron Shan Rebellion, there was no empire, no real control. Pieces of China were starting to break up. In fact, the Tang Empire never really reached out very far. The best it could do was to get into Central Asia, and there they only lasted for about just over 100 years, not much longer than that. That's just briefly, and I won't take too long about that. Simply go quickly through all those periods of empire, how were they explained by the historiography. So what we're talking about is not that China was one empire, but the historians, the official historians, right down to the present, made it into one continuous story, fitted in the periods of division into the periods of empires, and made sure that the narrative, that was a kind of simple, basic narrative, imposed upon it by Chinese official historiography to ensure that it all reached the same. As you know, it doesn't work like that, in fact, because you have the Wudai division followed by a very weak China in which the Song, the Liao and Jin, one after the other, were really divided all the time. There was no empire. If there was an empire, it was not a Chinese empire. It was the Khitan Empire in China, the Jurchen Empire in China, and the final climax of all, of course, was the Mongol Empire, which conquered all of China. And as I mentioned last night, we can say that there was a period of nearly a century when there was no empire, no China. There was no China, least of all a Chinese empire, only a Mongol empire. And the Mongol Empire is a fantastic empire. Never before had it known anything like that. And it covered the world right over all of a continental empire, all the way to Europe, to the Middle East, to the Fertile Crescent. And their descendants continue to dominate Central Asia, including India. As you know, the Mughal India, they were descendants of the Mongol-Turk confederations of an earlier period. So when you look at the whole thing, there was no Chinese empire from probably the middle of the Tang Dynasty to the founding of the Ming Dynasty. There was no Chinese empire. There were other people's empires, of which China was a subjugated part or a minor part of these empires. So the Ming, yes, it was an attempt to recover something of the Chinese empire. But in fact, if you look closely at the Ming, it wasn't much of an empire either. Essentially what it was able to do was to take back the areas that had been the Qin Han territories of, very interestingly, if you look at Western maps, even then we began to distinguish between what they call China proper from all the others. And China proper was all really what the Ming emperors controlled. And as you all know, they withdrew from the naval expeditions of Zhengke, they stopped altogether. They chose an isolationist policy, and in the north they chose to be very defensive by building the Great Wall. And the Great Wall, I think, is a symbol, not of greatness in a way, but a symbol of weakness, of holding the line, and a line that you found you couldn't hold by troops alone, you built this enormous wall to help you hold out against your enemies abroad. And so the Ming Dynasty, you call it an empire, it's a very loose term. It's certainly a kingdom, a state, a powerful central state that controlled the territories where the Chinese lived, the Chinese majority lived. But it was not an empire because it hardly touched anybody else's territory. It did try under Yongle with the naval expeditions impressing the people outside of China. It did try to take Vietnam and failed. It inherited the territories of Yunnan in south from the Mongols, which was not Chinese before that. Took it from the follow from the Mongols and Sinicized it little by little. But again, very gradually and in imperial terms, very minuscule, a part of what might be called an imperial enterprise. Essentially, it is a defensive kingdom, successfully defending its borders for about 200 years. And after that, again, finally, the Manchu taking it over the whole of China again, rather like the Mongols did, but this time in a very different way, and held China for 240 odd years. In between, the Chinese people were subject peoples for over 200 years. So what Chinese empire was there? So how did we get the idea that we have had a Chinese empire? And in the literature, in the Western master narrative, they talk about the Chinese empire from Qin Han down to the Manchus. And the Chinese accept it. If you look at the Chinese history, they more or less accept it. They also use the term equal. And I've been trying very hard to think, how does this equal apply to all those dynasties? It certainly applied to Qin Han. You can apply it to Sui Tang, yes. You certainly can apply it to the Mongol. You can apply it to the Liao and to the Jin, because they invaded and took over Chinese territories and actually ruled over large chunks of China. And you can certainly apply it to the Manchus, who were not content with China, but actually went further, expanding into Mongolia, into Xinjiang, and dominating Tibet as well. So they really expanded the frontiers for the first time, and I underline that for the first time in Chinese history did the border reach that far for such a long period of time. And sustained power exercised by the Manchus over all that area, which then, afterwards, in the name of the empire, became part of China. So that's that part of the story. Let me take you to the next step. The Zhongguo, where did that come from? Again, Zhongguo goes back to a long time. It was never many meanings, but it was never meant to be what we call Zhongguo today. As you know, the earliest ones, it was simply the little area that was controlled by the Tianzi, around which there are so many feudal states who tried to dominate this Zhongguo, which was the area control. But that's a very limited interpretation of the word Zhongguo. Zhongguo has many subtle aspects to it. And I would say that the term really became significant after the fall of the Tang Dynasty, in the Song. It was in the Song Dynasty, in the condition of desperate defense, you might say, for 200 or 300 years against Khitan, Jurchen, and Mongols, that a kind of ethnic consciousness among the Han Chinese majority who lived in the Song Empire began to develop something that might be called an incipient nation state, at least an incipient sense of a nation. And the term Zhongguo, as applied to this incipient nation, then has a different meaning from the Zhongguo of the past. But it was never used. It was never really used because the imperial narrative that the Confucian scholars expounded wanted it otherwise. They wanted this Tianxia idea, which I shall come back later to be inclusive, so that Zhongguo also becomes inclusive. Zhongguo is not the land of any particular people. Zhongguo is the land of an authority, a power system, an imperial system, blessed by heaven, the Son of Heaven, and therefore everything under the control of the Son of Heaven is part of Zhongguo, and Zhongguo and Tianxia gets intermixed in the course of that narrative by the Confucian scholars. But as a result of that, this Zhongguo never really develops into a nation or a nation state. No way. A nation possible, but not a nation state. This could not happen as long as that narrative was the dominant one. So the Song, after 200 years, when various elements seem to be developing towards a sense of a Chinese nation, didn't quite happen. Of course, we conquered by the Mongols, and then to get rid of the Mongols to set up the Ming, there was a second chance under the Ming. And I think there was something during the Ming which could be described as a very big step towards the formation of a Chinese nation. But this always clashed with the imperial narrative that the Confucian Mandarins preferred, which was that in order to make their history a single narrative of descent from way ancient kings, the kings of Wen Wang, Zhou Wang, and so on down to their own time, They had to fit everybody into the narrative. They had to fit the Xianbe and the Song Lu and the Tibetans and the Turk Chujue and the Topa Church and all the various people into the same narrative. And in order to do that, they could not allow an ethnic Chinese nation to despoil the story. So to fit that story in, the narrative had to include them all as being part of the same story in the formation of this Tianxia that the Confucians preferred to any sense of Guojia, which is a very limited concept, or Zhongguo, which is a limited concept. They would prefer that. So that clash between what the people felt and what the imperial rhetoric was talking about remained unresolved through the Ming Dynasty, even though many of the ingredients of a Chinese nation was, I think, emerging, were emerging during the Ming period. In any case, all that came to an end when the Manchus came in. Once the Manchu came in, the Manchu found it very convenient to accept the Confucian rhetoric, because that actually made it possible for them to claim to be the legitimate rulers of China, because they are now the inheritors of that great tradition. There's no Chinese nation, there is this Tianxia, and now it's a Manchin the Tianxia, instead of a Han-Chinese Tianxia, Manchin the Tianxia. So it fitted very well, so they were very happy to promote that ideal right through the Qing Dynasty. And you can see that in the rhetoric of the Emperor Kangxi, who channeled particularly, when it was very real, they were in control. And every aspect of what is happening to China and the original Chinese people was very much in the hands of these Manchu rulers. And so the rhetoric fitted very well. So Zhongguo, in that context, could not really evolve. It came under the Manchu system. So what really triggered the new interpretation of Zhongguo was really the Western impact of the 19th century. The fact that they were defeated by these national empires, the fact that they signed treaties with these national empires, the Manchu dynasty essentially stepped away from the Confucian rhetoric. Whether they were conscious of it or not, it's hard to say, but they essentially abandoned it because they accepted that all the old tributary nations no longer paid tribute to them. They accepted the idea that these Western nations had defeated them were their equals because they signed treaties with them. And therefore, as equals, then China was just like them. In other words, China was another national empire, a great power, like Britain, France, Japan, United States, Germany, and so on. That acceptance on the middle of the 19th century onwards essentially laid the foundations for the self-destruction of the Tianxia system. They didn't, I think, consciously do that. At least I'm not able to find anything to suggest that. But I think essentially that was what happened. And that, of course, was a disaster for the Manchu. Because the Manchu could rule the Chinese as long as it was in that Confucian umbrella of the Tianxia. But once you are associated with a nation state or national empire, then you can see how the Han Chinese thought that this was their opportunity to say that we are the nation, you are the invaders. You invaded us, so it is now a Manchu empire, not a Chinese empire. In fact, it never was a Chinese empire. It's a Manchu empire in which the Chinese were the subjects. And given the master narrative that the West provided, they could now, in the name of a Chinese nation, drive the Manchu away. And of course you all know that, but that's exactly what happened. All over China, Sun Yat-sen's rebellion, the Republic and so on, and the anti-Manchu movement was extremely successful, and very quickly the Manchu disappeared. The empire disappeared, and in its place was a republic based on the, at least underlying it all, was the idea of a Chinese nation, a Zhongguo. So the name, for the first time, appears as the name of a country. It's sometimes hard to imagine that China never had a name for the country. In fact, China is a foreigner's name for China. There's no such thing as China. China really only became real because the foreigners called it China, and the Chinese had to find an equivalent to China. Zhongguo was the best, so Zhongguo became the equivalent. So Zhonghua Mingguo was the first time that term was ever used in the whole of Chinese history. So it has a national identity, Zhonghua Mingguo. But remarkably, as you know, and this is where modern world history narrative is fascinating, because the world history narrative provides the Chinese with a choice. Their interpretation now could be that they have inherited all the territories of the empire. The Manchus should have gone home, but there were no home for them to go back by that time, because Manchuria had been taken over by the Chinese, so the poor Manchus had ended up in Tianjin or somewhere in hiding. But the Manchu aristocracy essentially has to disappear. But the empire then was inherited from the Manchus, therefore the whole boundary, the borders of an empire, could be inherited by the Chinese nation. Just as in the whole decolonization process in the 1940s and 50s, all empires inherited the empires of the whoever left it behind. I mean, best examples are India itself. There was no such thing as India. India was really a creation of the British. The British created India, but when the British left, the Indians inherited it, except that they didn't quite inherit it. The British somehow messed it up, so it ended up by being two or three bits. Now it's two main bits between India and Pakistan. In China was a bit more fortunate. The Manchus couldn't do anything, and the Chinese managed to hold up and hold most of the territories, but they did lose in the end. They did lose Mongolia. And there are, to this day, threats to some parts of those edges which are not entirely safe. I mean, Taiwan is one example, Tibet is another example, and who knows, the Uyghurs have ambitions to take out Xinjiang or something. But these are just part of the inheritance. But the Chinese argument, using the Western narrative, would be that we always was a Manchu empire, and we inherited the Manchu borders when the empire came to an end. So we can use the narrative to justify the present borders in that way. Unfortunately, the same narrative provides an opposite argument, and that is the argument which is used for the end of empires also, and that is self-determination by people who claim to be nations. If their claim is legitimate, if their claim can be verified in one way or the other, or is supported strongly by lots of people, then those claims can be validated by declarations of independence after self-determination. And so that is the opposite of the, and it clashes, the two are actually in opposition. And this is, I think, what China faces today. They've inherited an empire, and the argument is saying that you've inherited an empire with lots of people there who have claims to their nations, and therefore you must give them the right, some kind of autonomy, some kind of independence, perhaps, and that tension is still there, and it will continue to be there, it seems to me, for quite a long time. All this leads me to the final point about Tianxia. It's the hardest word of all. I've struggled with it. My wife says I can't explain it properly, and I totally agree with her. And of course, the Chinese could never explain it properly because they use Tianxia in so many different ways. In fact, as you know, in popular usage, even I can say I have a Tianxia. Anybody can say. For example, you can say a commercial Tianxia. 企业天下, you can say Li Ka Shing has a Tianxia. Everybody has a Tianxia. So Tianxia can be used in so many ways in popular usage. But what did the Chinese mean by that? We certainly, the orthodox view is the Confucian view of Tianxia. And where it went wrong was when Qin Shi Huang, right at the beginning, adopted Tianxia as part of his empire. He didn't use the word Di Guo. He called Huang Di, but he didn't use the word Di Guo because Guo is wrong. It's actually a Di Tianxia, not Guo. But Tianxia is bigger than Guo. Guo is only one part of the Tianxia. So Qin Shi Huang would not have been satisfied with that. He had to be Qin Shi Huang Di, but of a Tianxia. So the two words of the concept of empire and the concept of Tianxia from Qin Shi Huang onwards was to brought together. And they've been stayed very closely together because of this Confucian master narrative that determined all the historiography of China for the last 2,000 years. And that confusion has, I think, created more problems because it has failed to underline actually the ideal behind it, which the Confucian believed in. Because when they referred to Tianxia, they were really talking about Tianxia from ancient times, which really had no borders. It was really about the known world that we talked about earlier on. The known world is Tianxia. And whoever is the head of the Tianxia has to have, as it were, heaven's blessing, must represent a kind of moral authority in which respect flows naturally because of the moral authority. It has nothing to do with military conquest, nothing to do with the exercise of power, nothing to do with administrative control. It is an ideal, a kind of order, which is widely respected because of the moral authority that stems from somewhere up there, heaven's blessing, so to speak. That's the ideal that the first Confucian writers, and not only Confucian, in fact, the Warring States period, I was very struck by how many of those writers, whether they're Confucians or not, whether it's Merzi, Huangzi, or the Confucians, or Han Feizi, the legalists, or even Shangyang, they use the word Tianxia in that sense. Tianxia is not a country. It is not a piece of territory. It certainly does not mean a minzu or a particular people. And not controlled by any one people either. It is actually determined outside as a kind of by some cosmic force which determines the moral authority to be head of a Tianxia. So that was the original idea, but greatly ruined, you might say, by the fact that Qin Shi Huangdi adopted that as the basis of his empire. And that was an empire, a real empire. But that confusion has led to a lot of trouble. But fortunately, Chinese people are very sensible. They've been using the word Tianxia very loosely and without reference to an empire. As I said earlier on, if you look at the word how Tianxia is used, it really means it could be used in so many different ways, including, of course, a country, including, of course, an empire as well. But today I think what we can do, and why the Tianxia is still useful, because it can provide the basis for which the Chinese can actually bring together the two narratives to say, what is the ultimate purpose of the master narrative that the West had created? Is to create a world order which would ensure peace, an international system which can make sure that all those terrible wars in the past can be avoided in the future. It's an ideal, of course, no more than that. But the Chinese Tianxia ideal was also very similar in that way. The spirit of it was very similar. And so there is one way whereby the Chinese narrative and the Western narrative can come together to say that the ultimate goal of all our human activities is to create a world in which there is peace. A kind of Tianxia Taiping, the great peace of Tianxia, which is actually the phrase used most often in the most ancient texts that you can find, is the idea of a great peace under Tianxia. Nothing to do with war, nothing to do with control, nothing to do with administration, as I mentioned before. Now that, I think, is the where I would say that by bringing forth the fact that the Chinese ideal is the same as the ultimate ideal of the West of a world order, except that the Chinese have been passive, rather isolationist, and taken no steps to do anything about it beyond their own world, whereas the West, having expanded aggressively until it covered the whole world, now has the ideal turned into something much more concrete that is supposed to cover all peoples, all countries in the world, to bring together an international system. A much higher ideal on the ground, but in terms of the ideal itself, the quality of the ideals may not be all that different. It is possible, therefore, for the Chinese to bring this forth again and to say that all our other differences are differences of means, but not a difference of end. And if we could all agree on the end and start to work backwards towards the kind of means necessary to reach that end, then the two master narratives need not never conflict. They can actually come together fairly safely. Thank you very much.
Professor Wong has kindly agreed to take some questions. So I can see if they react in first and fourth floor. Yes, please.
Thank you, Professor Walker. I was going to talk and see what it is talking. I have a lot of data activity. So maybe I'm too greedy, I would like to ask for the question. Now, first of all, when you talk about the Eurocentric historical narrative, not narrative, and I guess it's related to the rise of the Western power without the industrial revolution. To me, say, before the Industrial Revolution, like the Jesuit coming to China and like earlier Marco Polo from China this year, fabulous China, and at that time, like in modern China, or in that era, was there ever a final sense of Marxist narrative or history in historiography? This is a new question. And in not there, I ask, now, China is coming up, you say that China can, and what is recession in the West, the economic recession is there, and all that. Would it be a chance that the final centric Marxist narrative come up in this world? And, or at least, if not, in the world, in the Asian Pacific or the Asian region, the different heads, the final centric marking of the history. Or maybe you can say, potentially, a chance at that globalization. So, globalization is that they know something of Western or China or whatever. So, the globalization is not a good thing.
Perhaps you would let Professor White answer the question.
That's a tough enough question to keep me busy. Let me say that I think the Chinese would themselves have to admit that they had a Sino-centric historical tradition. But it was a very limited Sino-centric world because they didn't expand anywhere. It was just really that they wanted to come in their comfort zone was to see themselves as the center of a civilized world. And that they were quite content to see that and leave it like that. Whereas the Eurocentric world stems from a different source now. It stems from the fact that they've actually exercised power over the whole world. And that's the difference. The Chinese never did. They only exercised it in a very limited area. Their known world was so much smaller. So even though they had Sinocentrism, it was no different from other people's Sinocentrism. Yeah, I mean, everybody had it. There's no difference for that. The range and the actual area that they were Sinocentric about was very limited. So it has no impact on world history. Whereas Eurocentric now has an impact on whole of history. So there's a big difference there. So Sinocentrism itself is harmless by itself because it was so limited. But today, if there should be Sinocentrism, as you, the second part of your question suggests, given the fact that the West is in retreat, in some areas, but that could be interpreted differently. Mind you, I personally don't believe that the Chinese want to be Sinocentric in that larger context. That I don't believe that they would have any ambition to dominate the world. And my understanding would be, and I actually had a concluding thing which I didn't read out, but perhaps I should read the last bit out for you, just to say what I had in mind anyway. My last conclusion was this. There is no need for the Chinese to reject the current master narrative. But China can emphasize that there is much in Chinese history that can actually contribute to that narrative. That's one approach. But China has to offer something coherent itself. And this is the one thing that China does not have at the moment. It has virtually thrown away its own traditions. It's not trying to recover bits of it, but it is still a very early stage, and we don't know whether they will ever recover it. Because in the meantime, China has accepted the value systems of the world in trying to grow economically, in trying to become a modern nation state. It has actually taken on so many parts of the political culture of the West as part of modernity. So being a modern nation, they cannot go back to some of those values. So given that fact, I think it's unrealistic to think of Sinocentrism in the same way. Is there going to be any Sinocentrism that would mean Chinese domination of the world? I think that's really would be terrifying to people, and I believe it's out of the question. China doesn't have the capacity for it. China doesn't have a coherent worldview yet that could actually make it credible. What does China has to offer today? What China has to offer today is successful capitalism mixed up with a kind of socialism with some heritage of Marxism somewhere in the background. But it is very mixed, and I would say basically incoherent at the moment. Anybody from outside of China looks at China today, what do they admire? What they admire is the economic dynamism which is based upon the free market of the Western capitalist system. So there's nothing peculiarly Chinese about it. There's no coherent narrative or message that the Chinese have to offer to say to the world, look at us and be like us or follow us. Nothing yet. So until they can achieve some clear direction of where China stands in a completely original way, then they are no more than being part of that master narrative. And I believe the Chinese don't have any ambitions to go beyond that, at least not at this stage. They have no position to demand more than what needs to be a significant part of their world history. Not to be ignored, not to be neglected, but to be taken seriously, and China has been consulted on any development in the world. And if a new world order is to be built up, China must be a major part of it, as it already is, but it can be even more important, but only relative to what it is today. More important, but not dominant, and not taking over any other system. And I think they're realistic enough to know that the world is too small now to think along the terms of the past. Communications, the globalization that you refer to, the globalization is not only economic globalization. The scientific and technological and communication systems of the world today means that you can control the world from almost anywhere. And I don't think China can ensure that it can have any dominance in that world. And what the Chinese do want, however, they want a world in which nobody is dominant. That is an ideal world. So if you want to have the great peace, a Taiping, everybody must be comfortable in it before you get the Taiping. And to be comfortable is to know that nobody is dominating me, but I'm also not dominating you. And that is the comfort. Now, if they want that comfort zone to apply to everybody, including themselves, then they should not seek dominance just as much as they want to resist domination by anyone else.
So, shall we let other people ask their questions before you go? I saw a hand from this lady there. I saw a hand from this lady first. The lady behind you. Excuse me. I gave the mic to that lady.
Excuse me.
Well, if I could understand correctly, in the talk you mentioned that in China, the concept of continent the Chinese had leadership of prosperity, and they made it, and their major achievement was to defend their own continent. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Continental, the continental part.
Would you please let me know how you understand the following two examples? Firstly, in the Tang Dynasty, the Han people also did some attempts to fight against the minority groups, so as to gain their position. Another example is during the Yuan Dynasty, the Xiongnu people, they also made some invasions. They also made some invasions in the West, and the Indians went as far as in the Europe. So, how do you understand these two units?
Well, in the latter case, very obviously, they were Mongol and not Chinese. Nothing to do with China. Nothing to do with China at all. It was a Mongol. And Mongols are not Chinese. Let's be very clear about that. And for the first question, it's a little bit more complicated, but I did suggest that what the Tang dynasty represented, or Sui Tang represented, was really something that emerged out of foreign invasion of China. The invasion of the Putu Xianbei people, the Koba Turks, for example, who ruled over the so-called Beichao, Nanbeichao division. Beichao was really all non-Chinese rulers. The ruling class was non-Chinese. The Hou Wei, Bei Wei, Xi Wei, all of them were of Xianbei origins. And they were the ones who produced their descendants became the aristocrats of the Sui and Tang dynasties. So it was really part of a consequence of foreign invasion of the territories of the Qinghai Empire. And so their attitude towards the steppe lands of the nomads was a bit different, not so defensive, because they knew them. They were themselves from there. They knew what dangers that the Tujue, for example, the rise of the eastern and western Tujue, the Turks, they recognized that this was a real threat. And they had a choice. They could be defensive, which I think the Han Chinese would tend to do, but what they did was they said, we have offensive approach to defense. In other words, what you call forward defense, that is a modern term, is forward defense. You have to go and attack them to make sure they don't attack you. But if you look at them, they actually did not, the Tang did not actually occupy a lot of territory. They attacked, and they left a few garrisons and strategic points, but they did not actually settle anybody there. They essentially just left them as defense system of garrisons, which didn't last very long. In fact, once the Anushan rebellion took place, all of those garrisons were gone. So the Tang was back to the original Han Chinese area. So that's the answer.
Yes,
according to your the concept of the Tsinghua Xianxia and also the concept of Xianxia and war state, is there any application to solve the conflict between China and Taiwan? For example, the question of the Chinese state and consisting of Taiwan
war. I suspect that if I had a solution for that, I'd be a very famous man. Anyway, I don't have a solution. Let me put it this way. Obviously, there are millions of people in Taiwan today who would like to see a Taiwan war. And I think we know that. Whether they can or not is not entirely up to them. We all now recognize, and the Chinese recognize, and the world recognize, a lot of it has to do with Sino-American relations. It's a straightforward matter between China and the United States. These are the two countries that can determine the future of Taiwan one way or the other. Exactly how it will end, I do not know, because I just simply cannot predict the future of Sino-American relations. I can only say that at the moment, they're pretty good, and because they're pretty good, there's no great tension over Taiwan. But this was not so a few years ago. So these things can change very rapidly. So I would not be able to predict what would happen then. But if you use the conceptual side, you know, in terms of the Chinese Guo, yes, there's a right for all the Guos to exist. In this case, the Chinese state, they do not legitimately exist, which, strictly speaking, in international law, they're also correct, because when China replaced the Republic of China, PRC replaced the Republic of China in the United Nations, the Republic of China left the United Nations altogether. It was thrown out and it was replaced. And therefore it had no place in the international system of nation states. It is not recognized as a nation state by the international organization that recognizes sovereign nation states. So once that is the case, so in terms of international law, existing international law about sovereign states, Taiwan is not a sovereign state recognized internationally. So that is the legal position, and the Chinese are just simply insisting on their legal position. So in one sense, they're just simply being very clear about their position and not shifting from it. The other sense, which is the other way, as I said earlier on, was to argue, the Taiwanese use the argument, that they were part of an empire, and that when the empire retreated, when Japan retreated, theoretically, they could have been an independent nation. Like Korea, when the Japanese retreated, Korea becomes independent, Taiwan becomes independent, why not? Except that, it was recognized even at the time, in the international negotiations at the time, that Taiwan belonged to China. And the Republic of China immediately took back Taiwan, sent armies across, and the Chiang Kai-shek's armies, the Kuomintang, went across the road to rule Taiwan. And at that time, as far as I know, the Taiwanese did not resist. Most Taiwanese at that time were very happy to rejoin the Chinese nation and free themselves from the Japanese. So all that happened, you know, at least for the first couple of years. And you remember the February 28th thing was a tragic thing which turned a lot of Taiwanese against the Kuomintang itself in Taiwan. But that was an accident, or much of a foolish or error, mistake on the part of the Kuomintang government, which led to the hostility. But that has got memories behind it. But today the issue is not that at all. Today it is an issue now actually with ideological underpinnings. The question of a democratic system in Taiwan, which the Americans support in every respect, and a system which both America and the Taiwanese people feel are not democratic on the mainland. So that is now the issue. It is no longer to do with international law, it is no longer to do with historical heritage, it is a fact now which can be used by the ordinary Taiwanese people to say, we don't want to be part of a system that is not democratic in our way. So that is their resistance to it. And the Chinese, of course, from Beijing's point of view, it is a democratic system which they can't accept for China. So they have to somehow resolve that. And I believe that that is why it is an issue between China and the United States. It is not an issue of borders, not an issue of law, it is not an ideological issue pertaining to a political system.
Thank you.
President Hua, you pretend to learn to speak and even create my thinking about war, okay, and about immigration, the immigrant. You know, in the old days, border, boundaries, wasn't it deep? So people you mentioned 400 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, came to China for training. Okay. Maybe they came tax and then they have warlords. Okay. Warlords control the village. Okay. It grows. But when the warlord actually
the warlord,
warlord, yes, warlord can be powerful. They set up their system. And then the citizen, they must be in favor of such a principle. They speak, they left, and then they migrate. Say, Jianghua made a lot of ships then, and then sail over the west and over the Southeast Asia. And then the migration actually started. Okay? Now, for so many centuries, you have to see the world so many yellow faces. Just the yellow face, I don't know whether they are for Chinese or Mongolia or whatever. But they are rich, okay? They are wealthy. So, please explain, our pinja would that be very strong in the next 20 years or 50 years?
I find it difficult to answer that because I don't quite see it the way you do. The Mongoloid faces you see all over the world consist of many different kinds of people. Japanese, Korean, Chinese, Vietnamese, many Southeast Asians too. You can't always tell the difference. And there are many Chinese who are from the Southeast Asia. They don't come from China. They've actually migrated and settled in Southeast Asia a long time. They're now spread all over the world. I also don't know that they're all that rich. Some may be, but my impression is the majority of them are quite poor, ordinary people. And they are also very poor Chinese. Not all Chinese are Li Ka-shing, you know. In fact, if I were asked to run a business, I think I'd become very poor very quickly. So therefore, I have to take a job, paper, that way. So I think given that sort of broad sense that you have, I don't think the question of Chinese can apply to just for the fact that there are a lot of Chinese people spread around the world. It's got nothing to do with it. And I think the concept of Tianxia really comes from the ideal of a world peace. Ultimately, I believe the most important part of my understanding of the most ancient texts where the ideals first were proclaimed was in the concept of a peaceful universe. I mean, taking broader sense, Tianxia Taiping, the Tianxia. And in that context, a guo, or anybody, people, guo, minzu, zhuqun, whatever it's like, are all part of it all, and they have to live peacefully under this moral authority. That's an ideal. And it has nothing to do with actual race or nation or any particular creed. At least that's my understanding.
My question is about the terminology. When you talk about Chinese in English, it sounds like Han. It's equivalent to Han, Hanjin in Chinese. But, isn't this a concept definition of Chinese in English as Han? Thank you.
Good question. Not at all. That is why applying a foreign word to the indigenous people very often can be very misleading. As you know, the Chinese actually don't have a single name for themselves. They have had many names at different times. I mean, I remember as a boy being very struck by the fact that all the Chinese I met in Malaysia, where I grew up, call themselves Tong Yan, Cantonese or Tung Nam, Hokkien. That was their term. That meant Chinese. But if I talk to my relatives in Jiangsu, they don't call themselves Tang Ren at all. They don't know what it means. What do you mean by Tong Yan? You see, to them, they're different. They are Huaibei Ren or Jiangsu Ren or something. You see, all of them. The names are different. You ask a Chinese, what are you? He identified in so many ways, but there is no one word which can translate the word Chinese. Because Chinese is a foreign word. Because the foreigners find there's so many varieties of Chinese, they could find one way to call them all, you know, give them one name. And they have done it everywhere. I mean, the word China, all these words are ancient words. They were used a long, long time, maybe 2,000-3,000 years ago. It's very controversial, and I don't know the answer. And most people say that the earliest one was in Sanskrit, was seen, and it's to do with China. And that became more or less the common word, and the Greeks use it, and the Malays use it, in the Malay language, and the Europeans arrived, they used the same word, China, became China, and Chinese. The Russians have a different word, they call us Kate, Kitai, because they looked at it from another direction. Looking at all those Mongols attacking them and so on, they all came from that place, which is Kitai, the land of the Kitan. Not even the Chinese. But to this day, the word for China in Russia is Kitai. So what foreigners call us, we can't help, you know. Yes, certainly.
When you said Mongolia is not Chinese, I think it's not agreed by the Chinese government nowadays. What is that? We have 56 minorities and 56 different kinds of people. So that includes Mongolia. Even if that's only the border and anyone you mentioned. So can we have a broader meaning for Chinese?
Well, I think that's a good question, but what that simply says is that since 1952, I think, Mongols have become Chinese by definition of the PRC. But it's not internationally accepted. The Mongols don't accept it. At least not all Mongols accept it. They may understand, they say that yes, they're Chinese citizens. They carry a passport of the People's Republic of Chinese. And you say that anybody who carries a passport of the People's Republic of China is a Chinese, that's all right. But you say, are you a Chinese? He said, no, I'm a Mongol. If you ask a Tibetan, are you a Chinese? You know, I'm a Tibetan. No, I'm not defending any position. All I'm saying is that these words, that was the word defined by the PRC government in 1952, I think, to the 56. In fact, it was a bit later than that when they agreed on 56 nationalities. As you know, the Chinese scholars took a long time to agree how many nationalities there are in China. When they first invited, I remember Professor Fei Xiao Tung explained this to me, when they first invited everybody to register as a minority, they had something like 200 or 300 around the country. And they had to sift them out. Gradually, to eliminate, and say, oh no, you two belong here, you two belong there. So it's all done by the sociologists and anthropologists in case. Well, I'm sure you may not agree. But, you know, that's how it was done. It was done by officials, bureaucrats, working out whether you belong or not. Are you two? Can you count you two? Or you two? Carrying them together, mixing them up together. And you ended up with some very strange mixtures. For example, there are some minorities, there are only a few thousand of them, and somehow they got identified as a minority. And the other minorities, which are hundreds of thousands, which the Chinese government does not recognize, and insist that they should be combined with some other group to become minority. So they ended up with 55, 56. But that was after a long discussion. But of course, Mongol is a very obvious one. They were a very large group, they had a large territory. They were recognized from 1912. And they were recognized, of course, before by the Manchu. If you look at the Manchu Empire, the Manchu Empire recognized the Mongols. And the Mongols were not Chinese. In fact, the Manchu Empire never used the word Chinese. As I said, the word Chinese in China was only used after the Republic of China was established in 1912. Before that, it was Qing. You are the subjects of the Qing. And under the Qing Empire, you are Manchu, Han, Mongol, Tibetan, or Huibun. These are the five. Wu Zhu Gong He, you remember from the Gong He Guo. And that's it followed. Actually, the Wu Zhu Gong He came from the Manchu dynasty. The Qing dynasty, the Zhuang Minguo actually adopted that phrase, Wu Zhu Gong He. The Gong He is new, but the Wu Zhu came from the Qing dynasty. So that, because they were the largest group, the most obvious group. But it was not until 1950s that the PRC decided to add all the other minorities. So all those minorities are very recent things. And I would say that, yes, we can say the Mongols are Chinese, but that is a purely modern definition. You cannot apply it backwards. You cannot say the Mongols are always Chinese. Just as you cannot say that the whole territory of the map of China today has always been part of China. I know people say that. I'm very careful. I hope I don't get beaten up for having said that. But it's a reality. You cannot go backwards and say this map of China is always like that. I tell you my story about Europe, which I find very, very at the same time amusing and yet very troubling. And that was in my student days. I first came across this problem when I read a history of Belgium. I told this story before to some people, but. The history of Belgium, very, very interesting. I was interested, what is this country? I realized it was only founded in 1821 or something like that, the Belgium. But the history of Belgium goes back to prehistoric man. And because if you drew a map of Belgium, and everything that happened within the borders of the Belgian map today belongs to Belgium. It goes right away back. It's what they call a tunnel vision, all the way back. So the first prehistoric man was going to be a Belgian. I mean, that's the kind of history. There's something wrong with that, somehow. You know? Because other books tell me there were all kinds of Germanic tribes in the area, and I read the Roman historians, Tacitus talks about all these Germanic tribes and so on. So where's the Belgian? Yes, there was a tribe called the Belgae, but we don't even know where they were, where their boundaries were. But all this is, in the history of Belgium, all Belgium. Just as much as history of Norway, the always Norwegians, and the Danes protest also. There was for a long time that Norway was part of Denmark, but then they somehow managed to rule out all the bits that they were part of Denmark, and Norway goes all the way back. Now, I'm just exaggerating a little bit, but you can see my point. So history of China, you say today's map, everything that happened in today's borders is Chinese, then you are being anachronistic. It's not reality. That is a historical approach, which is alright if you're very insistent, but it doesn't have any credibility. Nobody will believe it anyway. if you know any history. So I think this is a problem. You're right, and yet your thing is only dated from the 1950s. There was no such thing before that. I have to say, quite right.
So may I ask a question? So after that, I can allow one more question
okay.
before we allow you to leave. From your talk, I have the impression that an interest in world history is a sort of secularized Christian ideology, which is very different from the Chinese Tianxia. The Chinese Tianxia being very narrow, we're interested in a narrowly focused Tianxia in what we now call East Asia. Now, that leaves the Chinese scholar in a very difficult position. He or she either adopts the secularized Christian view of the world and abandons his or her Chinese characteristic, or persists in the view of Tianxia and continues to imagine in a very parochial way what goes on in that little part of the world. So the problem is that there isn't an arena, there isn't a problem area where the two trends of thought come together. Does that worry you?
I have a feeling that this is going to be inevitable. A parochial view of Tianxia will not be acceptable to the world. If China accepts that it is part of the modern world and wants to continue to be part of the modern world as a member, legitimate member with everybody else in the world, then they have to broaden their concept of Tianxia or abandon it. I don't think they need to abandon it, which is why I suggest that they can take it in its broadest sense, which was, I think was there from the beginning, which is the original Tianxia Taiping did not have any boundaries. It was not limited to what the Huaxia area. At least that's my understanding of the ancient usage of the Tianxia. They can return to that and get away from the Qing Han meaning of Tianxia, which associated Tianxia with the empire, and get out of from it. Because that was really Qin Shi Huang's use of it. He adopted it. He took it from and he gave it really part of his claimed it, as, and therefore all his territory under his control was Tianxia. And that gave it a narrow, parochial, and limited Sinocentric meaning. But I don't think it has to be like that. So if it's inevitable, the world being so small, that China has to be part of that, and wants to be part of that world, and to be accepted by the rest of the world as a peaceful country with something to offer, possibly to offer, then I think it is entirely possible for them to interpret Tianxia in the ancient way rather than in the post-Qin Shi Huang way.
You see, because there are practical consequences out of that that affect a place like Hong Kong. Mm. And we see it in the debate about the secondary school curriculum. We have a subject called Chinese history, and we have a subject called world history. And they're different subjects. They do not touch. They fit into those two worlds that you were describing. But you were suggesting that it should be meeting somewhere.
Yes.
There shouldn't be two separate subjects.
That's what I believe, yes. But otherwise, China is not part of world history. But I mean, that's what I'm really suggesting. That's why I say why I raise this very delicate and difficult question, which I've been struggling with. I may well get into a lot of trouble with it, but I just am offering that there is a way out. Because I think to deny that China is part of world history is not realistic. China is part of world history. And China has important contributions to make to world history, has already made contributions and can make some more contributions to world history. But it must be part of it. If it stands out of it and keeps separating itself from world history and not allowing the Chinese people to see themselves as part of a larger historical human history movement, as it were, they are actually preventing the Chinese people from sharing that world and from contributing to that world in a way which the world would be happy to accept. So you have to break away from those Sinocentric, if you like, And, I'm saying also the West must also break away from Eurocentrism. But there is a way to do it, and that's, for example, there are actually many, you might say, world views, many Tianxia views. The Indians have their Tianxia. The Islamic world have their Tianxia. The African world too, I don't know it, but I'm sure they have. And I'm sure in the Latin American world they have a Tianxia which is different from the Anglo-American Tianxia. The Chinese have their Tianxia. The Japanese too don't resist the Chinese Tianxia, as you know. And they would like to have their own Tianxia. Whether they have it or not, I don't know. But I mean, you can see that there are all sorts of claims for Tianxia. At the moment, the European one is the dominant one because they created the modern world through their industrial revolution, their science and technology. They now determine the parameters of this world. And what we're offering back to them is to say, yes, by all means, we have to accept that narrative, provided it is not centered in Europe, but it's a narrative that inclusive, is inclusive narrative, that includes all these narratives that are available from China, from the Middle East, from India, from Africa, and so on. You might say a kind of multipolar system, in which all these narratives are, have equal status of claims to contribute towards world history. Then we have a world history. And I think in that way, China is integrated into world history, participates and offers, contributes to world history, rather than continue in its isolationist, defensive, isolationist kind of the old continental Sinocentric position, which is to say, I must protect myself and make sure that you don't affect us, but we have nothing to offer you, and we don't really want to be part of you. I think that would be tragic.
I said I would have one more question. Let me see if somebody else wants to take it up.
I communicate with you in English. It's actually a historical history. Because, UK has conquered many different nations in the past. So that it is, we communicating in English is a tragedy of that consequence. When I was a small kid, I found that I'm a Chinese, why I need to learn English? But when I grew up, I know that I cannot survive in this society if I cannot communicate in English with others. English is actually a national speaking, national language. But sorry, it's an international language. So I, in my opinion, it's that I don't know whether it's right or not. Well, I just ask for your opinion. Nowadays, it, from the advent of the computer, our communication is much faster and our distance is closer. For example, if I go to UK to live tomorrow, I can use this technology to control my business. This I cannot do it. In another point is that maybe the tea shop, but the value of the right or wrong seems to be in the Western side, in the English speaking world. Because when we learn English, we cannot control ourselves to defend the content of the Western world because they are written in English. We automatically adopt the ideas of the Western world. Maybe, for example, in the future, the English speaking trend cannot be reversed. It seems to me it will continue in the future. So maybe the teacher is maybe the ground is in the Western.
We must allow Professor Wong to go at some stage. So so can you get to your point?
Maybe I want to know pizza, is pizza with the inclusion, is maybe based on the legal system, what I mean. Because we cannot control.